So did everyone do their homework? Does anybody just simply have any comments or questions about the homework and about the verse and the contemplation? Did it feel clear to people? Why do you think this was why was it helpful?
Yes.
Can you say why it was helpful?
It was a very logical progression.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't vague in any way. It was very clear.
Yeah.
She wrote through it. And I think that simple clarity just made it very digestible.
I see. How do you see in this passage or in this presentation of the middle way, the emptiness aspect? How does he talk about emptiness, the emptiness of paper? There's a particular little piece in there, kind of later on.
But if any one thing is missing, it can't exist.
Yeah, that's a piece of it, definitely. The whole universe was in the piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
But the paper, what about the paper? Where was the paper? Well, could we actually find something called a piece of paper with a determinate boundary?
Mm-hmm.
He says in there, actually, paper is made out of all non-paper elements. To me, that's the way of talking about emptiness. Because on one hand, when we looked into the piece of paper, did paper disappear?
No.
Not really. Like we could do this contemplation, and yet paper is still functional. So is it a denial of the functionality of things?
No.
We've done this contemplation in some of our intro classes with imagine your laptop, your Mac. You know,
yeah.
Really contemplate all the intricacies of, you know, it wasn't so much about an emptiness teaching, but more about really thinking about interdependence and how we're dependent on other people.
Yeah. Well, the thing is once you, like we were saying yesterday, once you start to look at the interdependence, then you're automatically moving into emptiness. So this was I like this very much because it's a way of looking at relationship and talking about relationship in a way that brings you right into emptiness there. So when you do this kind of contemplation, does it change somewhat the way you see a piece of paper? What happens?
Well, you begin to appreciate it more.
Yeah, you begin to appreciate it more. I feel that way too. Yeah. So much appreciation. Yeah, what else? Anyone else have any?
A sense of awe.
Yeah, see, wonderful. A sense of awe.
Freshness.
It didn't come out of nowhere.
Yeah, the paper.
Yes,
yeah, most certainly. Yeah.
It came from a store or whatever, but
yeah.
All this.
Yeah, and how it got there and who brought it there and all the intricacies of what it is. So I guess what I like about this is that it does, you know, we often think, oh, if we look at things in this kind of way, we're going to, emptiness often seems like a void or a vacuum or that we're losing something. But in fact, I think it enriches our understanding and releases a lot of intelligence. And so I thought maybe just to pass this out because it's kind of a good logic. It's really an examination, or it's really using my Gemmika logic. It's a little unconventional with the language. The word fullness is not generally used. So, you know, this idea of fullness is not used as much generally, but like in the paper, there's all these things as if it's a container. But we get the picture of what this means. Like, and as we spoke yesterday, words are very limited. So if you use the word fullness, you have a certain limitation of something being there. And if you use the word emptiness, it always kind of has this kind of tinge of nothingness just in the word. You know, language is so limiting. But this somehow takes us to a place of having an experience, at least a conceptual experience of emptiness, and that things don't disappear, that as we spoke yesterday, the relationship and the sense that it doesn't have any kind of true boundary can be there at the same time. And there's no losing of anything. There's just a freeing of our, a releasing of our appreciation and awe and everything that you've said. So what about the sentence that we were contemplating? Did you contemplate that a little bit? And was that helpful? Is there anyone confused about that? I just want to make sure. It's okay if someone's confused. We can clear it up maybe. Was it helpful to think of emptiness in that way? To understand emptiness through relationship and to understand how that works? Okay. Fantastic.
Phew. Although I have to say, when he in the handout, at one point he says, "What if we take?" I can't remember exactly what he said. What if we take the sun, send the sunlight back to the sun? I started thinking, "Uh-oh, that's what then?"
Yeah.
The sun is not the end either.
Is part of. Yeah, the sun is part of everything. I guess the point is you can't really do that. Yeah. Yeah. He's kind of playing with the ideas, in that poem. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I continuously like that and read it all the time and find it. And it's so poetic and beautiful and kind of not edgy. Sometimes emptiness teachings people feel a little bit edgy, like, uh-oh, like you're saying, what do I make of that? How do I understand that? This is very gentle. So I thought to just say a few things about, give a little context to these teachings. We have so little time, so usually I start off with the history, and I'm just trying to pick and choose what I can do here in our time frame. But I want to just say I'm really trying to present this as a practice path. So, like, for example, this Thich Nhat Hanh exploration investigation is like a kind of a way of introducing how the path-like quality of Majjhimaka, how we take things apart and we see how interdependent they are. So I'm going to continue, introducing just bits and pieces of what this path is like, Majjhimaka as a study, because it's a particular field of study within the context of Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism. In Zen Buddhism, they don't do this. This is particular to Mahayana Buddhism. But I think the main thing that I want to make sure is clear is kind of the view. What does this mean when we say things are empty? What does this mean? And the view is important to all aspects of Buddhism in the earlier teachings, very much in the Mahayana teachings. And then when we get to the Vajrayana teachings, there is no Vajrayana without understanding emptiness. As we all hear, emptiness and luminosity, emptiness and bliss. Emptiness is the basis for pure perception, because in fact, if you understand the nature of a piece of paper, the empty nature of a piece of paper, it's no different than the empty nature of the Buddha. So we find equality. Everything is of the same nature, then we can start talking about pure perception. If you don't see the equalness of all phenomena, then you can't practice. If you don't understand that, then it's hard to practice the Vajrayana. You just think there's all these deities and they're real, and the deities are kind of up here is very pure, and then everything else is impure, and then there's this very dualistic mind. Mm-hmm. And that's not the point of the Vajrayana. The point of the Vajrayana is to understand to practice pure appearance, that everything is of this empty nature, this luminous, nature. So therefore, in the Mahayana, we need to spend a lot of time understanding this view, which is one of the reasons very important, because so many people I notice practice of Vajrayana without an understanding of emptiness, and therefore run into problems. So this is a view that should infiltrate all your practices. And it's kind of interesting because I say the word view here tonight, but actually it's really a viewless view, which I'm going to get into in a little bit, because tonight I'm going to talk about views and beliefs, which is a big, important topic in the context of Majjhimaka teachings, views and beliefs. So I'll get to that in just a second. I just want to say a couple of words about the history, just out of respect. Now, the emptiness, and the the view of emptiness is beyond time and place, but there's a lineage of wisdom and wisdom teachers that brought the teachings to us here now, actually, at this very moment. And that is, the Buddha taught the Prajnaparamita Sutras, and he taught them in, I think it's 10,000 verses, 20,000 verses. He taught an 8,000 verse one version. Then the Heart Sutra is the most condensed that we have. And then they say you can condense it even further in the syllable ah. Mm-hmm. That is the most condensed, like the droplet of, in which is so interesting because she says ah is, that's what you experience when you have an experience of emptiness. It's like an experience of ah. I guess A-W-E ah. But it's kind of coincidental that awe is a sense of awe, because it's not closing down on any ideas or anything as being intrinsically true. So we have these different versions of the Prajnaparamita, and the Prajnaparamita, though, was really profoundly influenced these teachings by Nagarjuna. He really brought them into the world. He was some hundred years later, after the Buddha. He brought them into the world, and he distilled them and propagated them. They say he went down into the Naga realms, into the lower, not the lower realms of the hell realms, but the kind of the lower beings that live under the earth, and brought them up from a lake. And he's very, very famous and changed the way people understood them. And the Mahayana tradition became very strong, and then all these commentaries were written. For example, during the time that Nalanda was in India, the university was very, it was at its height, the bursting with new teachings and teachers and conversations about the Dharma. The Dharma was very strong at that time. So he brought this down, and then of course there have been many, many commentaries. Shantideva, Chandrakirti, Shantarakshita earlier on, great Majjhimaka texts and commentaries have been composed based on Nagarjuna's teachings. So that's how we are able to access them now. So I want, in some ways I'm thinking maybe tonight to almost do like a commentary on one verse that's always been very helpful for me. It kind of raises a big question that was important to answer for me, and I think it could be helpful maybe for you. So Nagarjuna said, and he was referring to the Buddha, Nagarjuna said, "I prostrate to he who has abandoned all views." I prostrate to he who has abandoned all views. So I want to look into what does he mean by views, and what does it mean to abandon views, and why would you want to abandon views? Here, views is a similar meaning to beliefs. I think belief is, maybe I'll even just use the word belief for a minute and talk about this word, because this is a word, before we get into even talking about what he meant, I think we all have a very different idea of what a belief is. There are many ways to understand the word belief. For example, if you look in the dictionary, under the word belief, you will find dogma, assumption, opinion. You will find to love, to cherish, to appreciate. There are so many different versions of belief. So I've thought a lot myself about this word. What does this mean to have a belief? And when I was reading a wonderful book by Karen Armstrong many years back, she wrote A Case for God. And she has an interesting history herself around what a belief is. But anyway, she talks about the etymology of belief. And she says that in the early translations of the Bible, you see this word pistis, the Latin word that the kind of the root of belief, which means to love, hold dear, appreciate, commit to. So according to Karen Armstrong, Jesus wasn't asking his disciples to believe in his divinity. He was asking them to believe in this vision of serving others, this sense of love that he had for others, this longing to serve others. So Belief here doesn't mean conforming to some idea or dogma at all. But it's more of a vehicle to move out of kind of a self-focused, puny little world of me. So I've thought a lot about the different ways we use this word. For example, sometimes we use the word belief. It's like an idea that we have with a strong sense of direction. For example, I don't know, has anybody seen that movie Conviction? It's a really good movie, Conviction it's called. But it's based on a true story. And it's a story of a brother and a sister who grew up in a very, very not caring, I think they just had a mother, they didn't have a father, and she didn't care for them at all. So they were kind of orphans, and she came around here and there, but they learned to survive, and they got very tough, and they weren't educated well, and they got into a lot of trouble. And then they grew up, and they got older, and the sister got married, and the brother was really wild and a little bit, you know, he was a troublemaker, basically. And so at some point in the movie, someone gets murdered in their town, and immediately he's blamed for that, and he's thrown into jail. And I can't remember if he's on death row or what's the situation, but he ends up in jail for a long time. And she has so much conviction. The interesting thing about this movie is he's convicted. So it's that kind of conviction. But I think it actually speaks to her conviction in him. She had so much conviction that he was innocent that she got her GED exams. Did you see it? She got her GED exams, so her high school degree. And she went to law school. She first went to community college. Then she went to law school so she could become a lawyer in order to free him. And she spent her, 15 years doing this. It was so moving. And, you know, her marriage failed because of it. She was completely obsessed. But she loved him so much, you know, because they helped each other survive growing up. Anyways, throughout the movie, you're pretty sure he did it because he was such a troublemaker. Like, he was so, was a live wire, you know. You knew he could do anything. And all kinds of things transpired. But in the end, he was actually, it was proven, it took that long for them to do DNA testing. So by the time they were able to do that, they found they still had saved some specimens, and they, you know, like some hair and some blood, and they were able to prove that he was actually innocent. But anyways, you know, this is interesting. This is a belief with a strong sense of direction. So this is one way that we use the word belief. And another way I think we use the word belief, and this is something I've often thought of, is like when you, for example, because I live in Crestone, it's very high altitude, and when you look up at the sky at night, it's extremely clear, and you can see the Milky Way and all the constellations, and it's quite clear and beautiful. And sometimes, you know, it's such a good exercise to look up, and then you. Things come into perspective, like maybe you're not as important as you think you are, kind of thing. So you feel humbled, you know, by the situation. And yet it's not like this small, self-demeaning kind of insignificance. It's that you actually feel a part of everything, and you feel as grand as that because you are a part of it. So sometimes, like that kind of experience, there's some kind of, maybe you could call it faith, you can call it belief, some kind of connection that I personally say maybe I would feel, I believe in whatever, I feel something that maybe has something to do with belief. This is a very profound experience, and I've often thought about this because it's not a matter of something being true or not. Like, I believe in that. It's true and untrue is not the lens you're looking through. It's just this presence, this way of being in life and relationship, the way you're in relationship to your world. And I think when you go to a lot of indigenous cultures, people have this kind of faith or belief in things. I don't think... You know, when I was studying anthropology and living abroad in South Asia and in Tibet and so forth, I realize people are not looking through this lens of what is true and untrue. For example, we hear the Guru Rinpoche's flying through the air, and we hear all these things, and sometimes we have a tendency to think, did that really happen or not? I don't think these people are questioning in the same way. I really notice that. Stories are a way of them to just be in life. They tell stories, and it inspires them. I've often told this story. I think I have time to tell this story. This is a great story. My mother-in-law, a Tibetan woman born in eastern Tibet, was a very great practitioner and had tremendous faith in Guru Rinpoche, in Padmasambhava. So, she ended up fleeing from Tibet with her husband and a couple of her children. And they were in Nepal for a long time. So when Rinpoche and I lived in Nepal together, we were all together there. Anyway, so one day there's a story. My sister-in-law told me this story that knowing that her mother loved Padmasambhava, she heard of a very low-budget film that someone in the neighborhood had made, video, about Guru Rinpoche. So she wanted to get her hands on it. So she got a copy of it. And they watched it. And some of you know the story, some of the stories of Padmasambhava, but he was a real ladies' man. And he started to mess with the king's daughter a little bit, local king in India, or somewhere around that area. Anyways, so the king was very unhappy about this. So he captured Guru Rinpoche and tied him up and put him on like a pile of wood with the intention of burning him. So So what happened was, well, they had to figure out how does a low-budget filmmaker in Nepal depict, this scenario. So they got all this crepe paper, like red, orange, and yellow, and they put it all around on the wood. And then to make it move, they had a little fan. So my sister-in-law says, like, the fire's going... And the fan is in the background going like... And so, my sister-in-law is a modern woman. I think she has a lot of devotion, but she's a modern woman. And she's seen a lot of slick films, Hollywood films and so forth. So she said she was laughing so hard. She was laughing and laughing, and she turned her around, and her mom had tears streaming down her face, So it's so interesting, the way she's looking at what's real and not real. And my mother-in-law is looking at the story in a very different kind of way, that it means everything to her, And what happens to Padmasambhava is that they burn him, but he doesn't burn. And instead, a great lake emerges. And this lake is now famous and quite close to where she lived in India. At that time. And she's not I would not say this is a stupid woman. It's just somebody who sees things in a different kind of a way. So this is an interesting way to understand belief, and I think a lot of people nowadays find that very superstitious or naive, but that's because they're looking through a particular kind of a lens. So I like to defend that kind of faith because I find it very... wonderful and very accurate in a way, because in fact there is, when we start to study Majjhimaka, we see there is no real and unreal. What is real then to us? That's a very good question. In this culture, we're very obsessed with true, right, real. It's very important to us. But in fact, there is no determinate truth. This is what we're learning. And even in the realm of science, there's this one theoretical physicist who studied with David Bohm, and who was also a colleague of Einstein or a student of Einstein. Anyway, he said that even in the realm of science, it is widely held that certainty is a failed historical enterprise. This is what he said, that truth is a relative thing. We all see things differently, and things are changing and dynamic and too full to pin down in that way. And we talked about this a lot yesterday. So, there's a sense that, do we really need to be right? Does something actually have to be true in order for us to respond to it or be in the world and be effective, it's kind of a very strange misunderstanding that we have. We think we need to know. We have to have the skinny on everything in order to function. But how have our beliefs, now I'm talking about belief in a different way, being right. Something being true, and because it's true, we're right about it. Or we are right about that it's true or that it's real. We have this sense that we can't function unless we know. But how has this kind of belief actually helped us function in the realm of relationships, rightness, or religious discourse, or politics? There is a way of being with one another and continuously learning without being right. This is why I like questioning. Like I was saying at Harvard last week, you know, I don't know if you like fresh air, Terry Gross. Mm-hmm. Well, I always love fresh air too. And the reason I love fresh air is because here is a person who really knows how to ask a question. And she is not stupid. And she knows just what to, you know, she knows what to ask based on just this, the kind of dynamic of the relationship as it continues throughout the interview. So it's just a responding back and forth. And it never ends up that anybody's right or it's true. It's just a conversation. And it functions very well. And what it does is it opens things up for us. You know, and we all hear it differently too. We are not right in the way that we hear it. And yet it's a process of continued opening and continued exploration. And it's interesting and it makes us develop. You know, it helps us learn, which is a continued process. So this idea that we don't function without believing in things, you know, this is what comes up here mm-hmm. in these teachings. There's a different way of being in our life. It's not limited to true and untrue, real and unreal. So I wanted to get at this a little bit tonight. So when I say, when Nagarjuna says, I prostrate to he who has abandoned all views, he's talking about views in this way, this sense of realness, this sense of rightness, this sense of true, knowing what's true and what isn't, you know, and how we close down around that. And this is very experiential. I'm going to get into that now. So this is the belief I'm speaking about. So today, I want to talk about different kinds of views. There are philosophical views, and there are views about how we see the world. So these can be individual views or cultural views that we share. Like individual views, we have all kinds of views, like, oh, I'm a bad person, or I can't do it, or life is scary. The world is a dangerous place. And we have also positive views that maybe support us in many ways as well. You know, sometimes like views that we cultivate, like bodhicitta, you know, seeing our people who we consider enemies as our friends and so forth. These are function to help us, not to say that they're true. They're skillful means that help us function and support us in our awakening and move us really out of some very heavy beliefs that we have about ourselves. So, you know, sometimes we make certain collective agreements in a culture. I always say we often have this in our culture, particularly the American culture, we have a collective view that to agree that we're not going to die. You know, there's this feeling, I mean, even though we know we are, we kind of hold this collective belief amongst us. And that belief has a very strong root. And the strong root is that we now exist. Once we think we're going to exist, you know, then we have to die. So this is kind of the big dilemma that we have. Existence and non-existence is a belief and a view that haunts us very much. So yeah, if we're going to, if we do exist, then we're going to fall into extinction. And there's a lot of confusion and fear around this. And this drives us in deeply unconscious ways. You know, we live a contracted life because of this. These fears we have around existence and non-existence. So these are the most basic fears, I guess. And these are considered views. is existence, and it's interesting because we might think, well, is existence actually a view? Isn't it just a fact? If you really think about it, how is that a view? And the middle way teachings teach them as a view. They call them views. Existence and non-existence are views. And I remember when I first started to study my Majjhimaka, I thought, how is it a view? Why is it a view? But now I understand how it's a view, and I'm going to get into that right now. These views, existence and non-existence, are really the main thing to be refuted or to be opened up and investigated on this path. So the Buddha said to his disciple Katyayana, in a Katyayana Gota Sutra, he said that things exist is one extreme, that they do not exist is another, but I, the Tathagata, accept neither is or is not, and I declare the truth from the middle position, the position of the middle way. So we're talking about, you know, this is a very important famous quote saying, you know, the root of all of our misunderstandings are based in existence, this belief in existence and non-existence. So, this idea of clinging to existence is very interesting if you think about it, because it keeps us in a state of fear all the time. Yeah.
Would you repeat that statement from the Buddha?
You bet. He says that things exist is one extreme, that they do not is another. But I, the Tathagata, accept neither is or is not. And I declare the truth from the middle position. It's very strong. Fierce. So, you know, I think a lot of beliefs, about beliefs from an experiential point of view, how do we experience beliefs? I would, like, as an experience, I would say belief is like a contraction in a certain way. I exist, and I don't want to not exist. Is almost like, it's not just a conceptual thing. It's very physical. It's very energetic, emotional, conceptual, all in one. And it's rooted in this fundamental conundrum we have about, you know, securing ourselves. Needing always to secure ourselves, because we're worried what's going to happen to this notion of self that's constantly haunting us, but actually we can't find when we look for it, which is the big irony of it. But I remember once my friend Rebecca here said, she was talking, and she said that how she experienced belief was a collection of energy. I thought that was an interesting description of it. A collection of energy. It's almost like a stagnant energy, like it's, you don't feel the fullness. You can, again, like a sense of contraction again around the energy. So, you know, I think with these studies, there's always this danger of getting very abstract or conceptual about it. But I think it's important that we bring it to the human dilemma. And that's what I'm trying to do here. We live in this state of contraction. And there's this really fantastic quote by Trungpa Rinpoche. He says about the human dilemma, "The bad news is you're falling through the air. Nothing to hang on to. No parachute. The good news is there's no ground." That's a good one, though. So this idea of hanging on, we're hanging on, hanging on, hanging on, but there's nowhere to fall. You know, I think ground and no ground is just another way of talking about existence and non-existence. Again, just to throw a little hint in there, when we talk about existence, think of the piece of paper. It exists in relationship. It's full. It's not this small, contracted, tight thing that exists in isolation and having to cherish and protect itself from the world, you know? But this is where we live, kind of feeling very independent and separate. So there's not that feeling of relaxation and appreciation like we feel when we're looking up at the stars, you know? So, you know, we hear this thing by Trungpa Rinpoche, and we can laugh at the irony of it, but hopefully it makes us deeply curious, too. maybe even desperate to find out. You know, there's something unspoken here. We're falling, but there's no ground. What does that mean for us? So when the Buddha declares the middle way position, he's pointing to this too. I, the Tathagata, accept neither is or is not, and I declare the truth from the middle position. So we're calling into question this belief that existence is a fact or a truth. And if it's not a truth, it has to be a belief, right? If it's not a truth, if we can't really find it, then it must be a belief that we impute upon our experience, a way that we see things, but it's like a conceptual fabrication. It's a contrivance of the mind. It's a misunderstanding. It's extraneous to the way things are, is how we might say it. So, so it must be a belief. So, if we begin to question the idea of existence, existence immediately starts to fall apart. So, we don't have to really even get into non-existence. We can just talk about existence tonight. Then you'll see why we don't have to talk about non-existence. So, I looked up existence once in the dictionary, and I found two really great, helpful descriptions. The first description is one we often use in the Dharma, is that things don't have an objective reality. So existence means having an objective reality. That means that aside from our perceptions of it, it has its own qualities. It has its own label. It has its own way of being. But in fact, can that be so, since we all see it differently? And that it's made of parts and compounded, and it's completely dependent? So this is one question. So the first one is, the existence is having an objective reality. The second one really caught my eye. Continued survival. Existence is continued survival. I find that painful, just the term. Continued survival. It's like, we don't want to just survive here, do we? You know? So let me... hopefully we're going to do more than survive. But it feels like we're surviving oftentimes if we're always grasping and rejecting, wanting and not wanting, trying to keep everything, maintain ourselves in a world that's continuously changing and dynamic and doesn't lend itself to staying still. So there's a pain in it. So let's talk about continued survival first. So, I thought the term survival captures the struggle we have in the human condition. We're struggling to survive, and basically we can't. So we're holding on to ground where there is no ground, and we have this deep fear of losing it, this deep fear of dying, this deep fear of loss, and this deep kind of continued hankering for things. So it's not very pleasant. You know, it's not a pleasant way to live. So that's continued survival. Now, having objective reality is quite interesting. And it takes us in a little bit more of a philosophical direction. So an objective reality means that outside of our perception of things, something exists in a particular way from its own side. So what is it from its own side? What does this imply? It means it would have to, what would be the qualities of something that existed from its own side? It would have to be, number one, I have a list here. It would have to be intrinsic. Intrinsic meaning it was contained wholly within itself, outside of relationship. So, for example, we often think of God. People often think of God as intrinsic, like it's something eternal that doesn't change. But of course, yesterday we talked about that if a God is creating things, then just in even order to create its creation, it has to be in relationship. And once something is in relationship, it can't be intrinsic anymore. It can't exist from its own side. It's vulnerable in the sense that it's always moving and changing and made of the same stuff as everything is. God would be made of relationship again, just like everything is. So in this way, it's hard to find that. It doesn't have an essentially true nature in that way. If something were intrinsic, it couldn't be open to interpretation. Everyone would have to see it in the same way. But that's never the case. We have trouble just coming up with a good healthcare plan because we see everything differently, so let alone, you know, it would not work. To exist from its own side, it would have to be unalterable, means we couldn't change it. That's the second one. It could never change. It couldn't, so therefore, again, it couldn't be in relationship because things that are in relationship could never change. But is there anything we ever experience that doesn't change? Change implies movement. Sometimes we look at something inanimate and we think it doesn't change, but if you slow down, you'll know that, of course, everything changes. Sometimes you might not be able to perceive it, but over time, everything changes. And in fact, because you are aware of it, your perception of it continuously changes too. So to try to find something that, and you should try, slow down and look and see, is there anything that's not subject to decay in this world and change? Do we experience anything in that way? And then the third thing might be that it's unconditioned, free of causes and conditions. Have we ever seen anything that came into being without causes and conditions? Again, it's important to pause and look. I wish we had a little time to pause here, but maybe I'll just keep going because of the time factor. So maybe this can be a homework thing for you, just to pay attention. To exist from its own side, it would also have to be independent, again, which means not in relationship, you know. For example, how could such a thing be known? Like I was saying, you know, the cup is not independent from my perception of it. So again, we can't speak of something that's independent. Subject and object come together to make knowing possible. So that's independent. To exist from its own side, it would also have to be singular or uncompounded, meaning that not made of parts. Not made of parts. So is there anything not made of parts? They say in this tradition you spend a lot of time looking at matter and consciousness. You know, matter, you can break it down until you find the smallest particle of matter. I don't know in our culture, what is it now? Strings or quarks or... Vaishali, is it strings still? You sent me something on strings once, on string theory. I don't know what, you know, I'm not so up on... God particle. Yeah, okay, God particle. So the God particle, science has spent years looking for what they call a God particle. I've heard different explanations of this. Some people say the idea of the God particle is that it gives matter mass and holds the architecture of the universe together. Yeah. So maybe that's why it's called a God particle. That makes sense. I don't know. But the belief in science is that if we find a God particle, it would prove the origin of the Big Bang. Hmm. So they're always looking, and they've created this machine some years back that is like the most expensive machine ever made or something. Mm-hmm. And it spins as fast as the speed of light, and it tries to break particles, and they're looking for the smallest particle that's unbreakable. But here, as long as it is a particle, it has parts. Mm-hmm. Particle, part. Like, as long as there's something you can point to and say, aha, there's something there. It has, like they say in the text, it has sides. It has up and down in four directions. And so, therefore, it must be made of parts. Whether you can break it or not doesn't mean it doesn't have parts. You maybe just don't have the technology to break it apart. And the same as can be said for consciousness. Consciousness is made of moments, and each moment has a past, present, and future. And when you break those apart, there's another past, present, and future. So everything is compounded together. So, and this is a very Majjhimakan investigation, to look into part, to matter, and to look into consciousness and see if it has some kind of intrinsic reality to it. And of course it doesn't. Gina, do you have a question?
It actually did. Singular was the last one that you said. Did you?
Yeah, this is, I'm still on singular.
Oh, okay.
So you could say singular / uncompounded. Because we think it's one, but actually it's made of so much.
Sometimes I get confused about the presentation of singular and autonomous.
Yeah, autonomous is like it exists not in relationship, that it has its own...
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, not in relationship, so, where singular means it's not many. So here, like, we're breaking it from the inside. Like, yeah, like there's a parameter and we are looking into it. with autonomous, we're looking at the connect, usually to the connections more outside. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it is. That's a good point, actually. I haven't thought of that so clearly. So, again, I'm going to just name them. Have you ever seen anything that is intrinsic, unalterable, unconditioned, independent, or singular, or uncompounded? This is the question. Something to think about. Have you?
Well, no, I'm just...
Oh. Tell us!
No.
You might just blow this whole thing for us.
At some point, maybe we'll talk about it, but I mean, awareness, for example, awareness.
Yeah.
Like full, when you are full, like one of my teachers at one time, I asked, because a lot of times people will say, well, awareness, you know, and you keep looking, well, who's aware? You know, and the teacher eventually said, awareness is aware. And that space of like when you wake up, when one wakes up, there's awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that...
Well, awareness is interesting because there's different kinds of awareness. So we have to be very specific about it.
The capital A awareness is...
Yeah, the capital A awareness is the emptiness itself. So
yeah.
We'll get to that,
yeah.
Hopefully.
I thought we were going to get to it.
Yeah, because ordinary awareness is dualistic, so it's always in relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're aware of the subject and the object are working together. This kind of awareness, or we can call it emptiness or dharmata, this is the viewless view that we're getting to. And so we'll see how that works. So we're moving in that direction. So it's good that you're thinking. So it's important to look and not just simply say, oh, well, I guess not, but really kind of think about it, right? That's part of the process of being having a lot of conviction. We never, before, at least, I don't know about you, but before me, I never thought of any of this. Why would you even, what would even lead you to think of this, and why are we thinking of this? But it's a pretty amazing thing, what it can do. It's an unbrainwashing process. Like, you will see how deep your beliefs go. Do you know what I mean? How deep your beliefs go. I'm not a good person. I don't like that person, you know. Just, like, really simple things. But it's all about maintaining your life and holding it all together and not wanting it to fall apart and wanting to feel secured. So you'll see that how this questioning process really infiltrates your life. And you'll we constantly see the world as real. We objectify things and we attribute qualities onto them, people, as if they existed from their own side. Like she's untrustworthy, you know? Maybe... Sometimes, yeah, you know, but you'll never have the final data of who someone is or how things are, because the world isn't like that. So, for example, you know, a moment of self-doubt arises and we believe it's who we are, and there's a strong sense of existence in that, and there's a strong sense of almost the opposite of existence, like this kind of, I'm nothing, I'm nobody. Kind of like a non-existence experience goes with it. You know, all of a sudden we don't know who we are and we get depressed and there's meaninglessness. These are all beliefs with the root of existence and non-existence there. Someone does something we don't like, we get angry and we believe our thoughts and emotions. You know, we believe what we think, we believe what we feel, we believe we're right. There's so much rightness and anger, you know. So there, again, there's a sense of existence and rightness. You know, we sit to practice and, you know, our thoughts and emotions, and we have all kinds of experiencing burgeoning up in our awareness. And we get lost in the momentum of our thoughts. We think they're real. They have some feeling of existence. And when we're not lost in our thoughts, we're kind of, there's a subtle form of rejecting them, not wanting to experience them. That's the non-existence part. So in some sense, there's the eternalism and nihilism in our very practice. And the reason we can't stay with the experience is because we feel it's so real and we can't bear it and we're always trying to escape it and manipulate it. And therefore, if we didn't think this was all real, if it didn't have this sense of realness to it, it would be easy to sit in meditation. So, you know, they always say, they talk about co-emergent ignorance a lot in the Dharma. Co-emergent ignorance is simply just getting overwhelmed by this sense of realness. You know, even before the thought process begins, which is the random labeling, the second ignorance, the first thing that happens is this sense of realness in our experience. So It's hard to experience the rich energy of the mind because it seems so real at every moment, even though it's shifting continuously and based on causes and conditions and compounded and everything, we still get caught in our meditation. And that's why it's good to meditate, so you can see that there's a problem there. There's a real problem somehow. How do we deal with it? How do we relate to this rich energy of experience in a different way? Even within the context of the practice is the middle way. Middle way is just another word also for practice, for genuine practice, for resting the mind. So you see how important the middle way is? Are you starting to see why we need to understand it? Oh, goody. Okay. Yeah. So these teachings suggest that things are not limited to the beliefs we have about them. It can be conceptual beliefs or non-conceptual beliefs, philosophical beliefs, whatever. We continue to feel so right. Things seem so true. And then we lose our ability to accept and rest in the fullness of things. And our mind becomes extremely naive, not savvy. That's a naive mind that continuously thinking things are real that are not. Now, again, real, not real does not mean you're denying an experience. Real just is a way that we experience things that's a misunderstanding. This is where people get lost in the nihilism thing. They think it's saying, oh, it's not real, like, is a way to dismiss it or deny it, you know, or you can't enjoy life because it's not real. So you have to renounce it, you know, like in the sense of get rid of it. What we actually want to renounce is our grasping and rejection. You can't renounce the world of phenomena, the rich energy of experience. It's unrenounceable. But you can renounce your grasping and fixation. Again, like Talopa said to Naropa, this is like the most quoted quote, "Son, it's not appearances that bind you, but it's your grasping and clinging." So this is how we always have to remember that when we're talking about renunciation. So it's very important because this is how we don't have a sane relationship. We can't have a sane we talked about sane relationship sanity in relationship yesterday. This is why we can't. We're totally misunderstanding the state of affairs. And we're completely naive, and we're wanting and not wanting something that has nothing to do with how things actually are. So all these beliefs we have are extraneous to the very natural way of being. Why are we not naturally understanding this is just a good question, but we're not, and it's very evident that we're not. So, Bill. No, go for it. It's okay. We can ask in the teachings.
So could you say more about, I don't understand what you were saying, even before we do the words and we move it into sort of, there can be a sense of realness.
Yeah. You bet. And that's a very important point. You know, when we talk about the 12 nadanas, like the 12 links of dependent arising, of course it's circular. Does everyone know what that is? No, I don't think everyone knows. Yeah. So you know how we have these tankas of enlightened mind, like the Buddhas and all the activities of the Buddhas? We also have a depiction, like a illustration in the Dharma of what a confused mind looks like and how it comes about. If that can be depicted, it is in a very interesting way. So it's a picture that's circular because our confusion is not a linear thing, like it didn't just start in one place and here we are now. We keep creating confusion for ourselves again and again. So in this circle, there's these 12 pictures, and I can't get into all of them tonight. But there's not a beginning and end to the 12 because it's circular, but there, if there is a beginning, the first one, it's always called the first one, is called ignorance. And this is the co-emergent ignorance that we're talking about. The picture of that ignorance is a woman who's blind with a cane. And the understanding is that she's blind because the truth is the phenomena, the rich energy of experience is too overwhelming. It's like when you sit in meditation, you feel like you can hardly bear it. Do you know what I mean? And so we keep, so this is like the genesis of the confusion, but this is a momentary thing every moment where before we even label it, there's this division. It's real. And then it becomes, we put like name and form and all those different aspects of labeling and acting out on it, and the emotions that come with it come after that initial experience of the basic misunderstanding that we have, co-emergent ignorance. So that's what it speaks to. Before the name and form and all that comes the just the basic misunderstanding. Yeah.
Would that be the seventh consciousness?
That's the afflicted consciousness, the sense of I guess you could say that, because what that is a division. There's a sense of self-consciousness, but it hasn't become conceptual yet. And this holding on and the cherishing and protecting starts there. Like this initial overwhelm and then the reaction to that. So there's a self and another. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So like in your book, so it's when we do objectifying before we've even gone the next step.
Right.
There's objects.
Yeah, there's objects and there's a sign of something to cherish yourself with and protect yourself from in this kind of feeling of like self-consciousness or something. So that would be the afflicted, the seventh consciousness. Yeah. Yeah, of course. So, yeah. So, you know, we often think we have these kind of because of all of this, our philosophical beliefs actually start to surface, you know, when we question these kind of things. We have a lot, we actually each, if you look, actually do have a lot of more philosophical beliefs than we think. And, you know, people often say things like, you know, about existence, well, wait a minute, hold on now. This thermos, you know, is real. You know, the mountain is real. Look how solid it is. It's solid to the touch. You know, how can you say it's not real? And we have these kind of ideas that if something is hard and dense, that it's real. Do you know what I mean? Like, actually, something that's hard and dense, like a mountain, is just as real as a bubble. It just happens to be soft and poppable. But it still rises in relationship. Do you see what I mean? So this is a good one to talk about, because see how we have these beliefs and we don't see how things are in relationship, and we divide things up and we think we know, and so fascinating, you know, and exciting too to discover. So, you know, a rock is not a real thing. It arises based on causes and conditions. You know, somebody might see a rock as like, like a geologist might see like elements that have been amassed over time, and an animal might see it as a place to live, or a rock climber might see it as like a climbing problem. That's what they say, like how you get up is a climbing problem. Or we might see it as a sacred place. You know, who's right? You know, no one's right. So therefore it can't be real. It's not true. It doesn't exist from its own side. And it's compounded, you know, and doesn't exist in isolation. So, you know, another misunderstanding we might have is that we are real because we feel and experience the world. But feeling or consciousness doesn't prove existence. Actually, the things that make us feel, you know, I talked last night, like if we are pricked by a pin or somebody hurts our feelings, just proves that non-existence, that things aren't real, that things that only exist in relationship. Because it's our relationship with that pin or that other human being that evokes the feeling that we experience. So, you know, we, again, it's not a denial of relationship. I read something recently by Trungpa Rinpoche. He was trying to explain that emptiness doesn't mean things aren't real, that you can still enjoy your cup of coffee. And in fact, maybe you enjoy your cup of coffee more, just like you enjoyed the piece of paper more. It's not like everything you do, you have to do that whole analysis. But doing this analysis, but the interesting thing about the analysis is the more you do it, it shifts your way of thinking, and then you naturally start to see things. It's like you're moving out of your abstraction. We think Majjhimagga is very abstract, but actually the purpose of Majjhimagga is to move out of abstraction into relationship. Relationship is less abstract than labeling something. Isn't that interesting?
See, this is. I had that in our one of our groups. We spent a lot of time with Nagarjuna, and I had a terrible time with it.
Yeah,
and it's just
hard.
All this struggling with the abstraction and what I would call learning disabilities. But what I found is over a period of time, the cumulative effect was just as what you described, was a sense of more openness, and it's like a sense of getting it by osmosis.
Yeah,
and
you get it.
And it was, even though it didn't come easily,
yeah,
there was an experiential
right on
aspect
yeah.
to it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think this is what happens. Mm-hmm. Like you do the work and you just trust it. It happens, and you can see this is really mm-hmm. fantastic stuff. It really blows your mind apart. Yeah, Gina.
As you're talking about this and doing the homework, it seems like it would be really helpful to go through things that you get stuck on, like ourselves. Mm-hmm.
Very helpful.
Or the hard thing.
Yeah.
To do your own breaking it down.
Absolutely.
Like Thich Nhat Hanh
did. Yeah, absolutely.
What is it all contained in there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm trying to throw out little hints of things that you can contemplate, because in 3 nights, this is really like a ambitious endeavor for me to try to do this in 3 nights. And also I've thought a lot about how I could create some really interesting contemplations, because sometimes the texts are hard. They're a bit cryptic. Sometimes they can be a bit boring. Actually, I haven't been bored with them exactly, but just a little, they're hard to get through. And maybe there's no way to get through them without struggling a little. I think that's just part of the deal, you know. But maybe a lot of people, this is my big like beef that I have, is that maybe a lot of people aren't going to get to those. What if you all don't get to those? That takes a lot of commitment. I've been studying this for almost 30 years, you know, and I don't know if everyone has that opportunity or time. I happen to have a teacher who's really good at teaching this. Well, you definitely do. But he's not around all the time, you know. So if you can do it with him, it's great. And maybe now with this kind of background, you'll understand more why you're doing it. But what if people don't understand? At least you could get them some idea, so when they hear the word emptiness, they know. They have a sense. I think that's really reasonable. And I think hopefully, you know, you're getting to some extent what this is. Maybe not just because of me, but, you know, Trongrum, she, I'm sure, much better. So sometimes, you know, when we think that things exist as autonomous entities or independent entities, we misunderstand the Heart Sutra. Because in the Heart Sutra, it says, no eyes, no ears, no suffering, no cessation of suffering, you know, no, everything is no. So, you know, the classic misunderstanding is that no means nothing. No means no. You know how your mom said, no means no. Here, no doesn't exactly mean no. It's talking about no intrinsic existence. And it's making a list of those. It's a certain style of doing it, a certain school. It belongs to a certain school to just take a lot of things and break it apart and say no. It's called like countable emptiness or approximate emptiness. It's still kind of within the realm of conceptual mind, but it's a way of just remembering that when you look for it, you can't find any separate thing there, anything that exists from its own side objectively. That's what that's about. Sometimes I got this man wrote on my blog this question: if when the nature of things is realized, there's no confusion, no samsara, no sentient beings suffering in samsara, then what's all this Madhyamaka Mahayana rigmarole about saving those so-called beings from this so-called suffering? You know, he wrote me some other questions too, which I will not repeat here. He was a character. I actually don't know if it's a man, but I felt it was a man. Something about it. Anyway, so it's a reasonable misunderstanding when you hear the word no eyes, no ears, to think no, like as in no. We usually understand no as non-existence, the absence of something. But when we can't find an intrinsic thing, you know, how can we talk about an absence of an intrinsic thing? This is always the question, you know. So we've been looking, you know, now for 2 nights. So it's not just a language question, but it's a deep misunderstanding we already have about the way things are, because we think things exist, therefore we think they're not going to exist. But what we're really referring to in no is that we can't find a true boundary because everything is in relationship. Because everything is in relationship, everything is empty, as we've been speaking. So please understand, no is not the opposite of existence in this context. It's not denying or rejecting anything. No here actually means just empty of intrinsic existence. So we've been reciting the Heart Sutra, so it's good to say something about that. So I just want to say a few things. Hopefully, are you with me still?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, I know this is maybe challenging material, so I don't want to overwhelm, but let me just, I'll try to get through a few things. So philosophically, let's just look real quickly at some views. And there's two main views in the Majjhimikins categorize all the views into two main compartments. The views that are eternalistic and have to do with things intrinsically existent, and things that are non-existent, and this is nihilism. So eternalism and nihilism are the two. Ground and groundless, is and is not, are another way of talking about it. So, for instance, when we take emptiness to be a void or a negation of something, that's nihilism. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, there's, like denying the appearance. Like, as if you say it's empty, there's no appearance. Nothing functions, but that's obviously not true. When we hold on to existence or realness, and think things exist from their own side, it's eternalism. So in the middle way tradition, there's a lot of debate. There's a lot of debate. It's not a debate to try to distance ourselves from others or prove that we're right. Or assume some kind of disembodied stance that we try to defend it. The debates start with our personal confusion and trying to find a way out of it. And that's why we have the debate tradition, is because we're searching for this wisdom, this middle way wisdom. You know, where is it? What is it? How do we get out of this sense of dualism? So what are the implications of something being intrinsic from a philosophical system? The debates get very specific on this, and I think sometimes in the context of emptiness, the different schools that are arguing sometimes sound very weak. People think, oh, they're just straw men. You know, they just set them up so they can knock them down, kind of thing. But in fact, if you really listen to the logics of the different schools that are debating with the middle way proponents, they echo our own confusions, very, very much so. We're always falling into nihilism and internalism, as we've been talking. You know, we're trying to find ground, and we're looking for a creator or a God particle in philosophy, or we're denying ground, and then we're denying the cause and effect, or, you know, that there's nothing there, and there's a sense of maybe meaninglessness, too, in it for us. You know, so we're trying to find intrinsic meaning, and then we bounce back and forth, and then we find meaninglessness, you know? Mm-hmm. So study helps us refine our views. So I want to say something about the realists, the eternalists, and introduce one view tonight so you can get a taste of this. It's very similar to how we look at science, actually, this particular view. We're trying to find an absolute cause for appearance, so it's like this God particle thing we've been talking about. You know, we're looking at something relative and we're thinking it's absolute. This is what we're doing. Or we're looking at a moment of consciousness and thinking that exists. So in the path of the Buddhist tradition, we have the Mahayana tradition, which is like the foundational vehicle. And the Mahayana is, the teachings of the Mahayana are actually some of the most powerful teachings I think, I always feel that there are. Without the Mahayana, there's nothing. Because, like, you can't have a peak of a mountain without a base. Mm-hmm. There's a base of everything, and if you don't understand them, there's no peak. And yet, the way Buddha taught emptiness is extremely gradual. It's a little shocking at first, this emptiness thing. So he was careful. So in the beginning, Buddha taught us to observe cause and effect very, very carefully. And this is very important. And there's never a negation of cause and effect anywhere in the Dharma. emptiness does not negate cause and effect. Things still function, they just not intrinsic, real, static. So the Buddha taught that cause and effect exist. I don't know if he says the word existence, but he taught so much about it that people clung on to that as true. Okay, well, it certainly seems to work. True is a whole thing, a necessary thing to apply on that. It's fine as a functioning thing. Why does it actually even have to be a solid truth to cling to? It just seems to work, so, you know. So people hold on to it as a philosophical view. The Hinayanaists, the Shravakas, and the people, the proponents, they're called the realists. We'll just use the word realist here. Believe in these, what they call the particleless particles and the and units of consciousness, the momentless moments. So they believe there must be something there, or else what comprises all this world that we live in, the phenomena, the moments of consciousness and the experience of consciousness and matter that we have in our so-called reality. So the early Buddhists insist that they exist. If not, they say, how would things appear? So there's this story in the sutras where there's these two monks, and they're at one of the Buddhist teachings, and he started to teach about emptiness. And it so overwhelmed them that I guess they had a heart attack and died. This is what it said. But I can understand that. Like, you're so devoted to the Buddha, and he's telling you this, and all of a sudden he pulls out the rug completely. Of course, our teachers do that all the time, but we're used to it, I guess. Anyway, philosophically, when you're holding on to something and then it's taken away from you by someone who taught it to you, it's a tough thing. So, you know, they believe that the things, you know, that consciousness arises in, like, I think the number is 1/60th of a second rising. A subject and object are coming together and knowing is taking place. And it gives rise to what we know. It's kind of like frames of a film. And this is how it appears. And, of course, appearance is not denied here. Things are functioning and working just fine. It's just this kind of realness is not happening. So it would be ridiculous to deny experience. At the same time, we're only just looking into this sense of realness, and we're looking deeper. You know, what could be a particle is particle if it doesn't have any parts. Then how could you, why even speak of it, you know? But they're clinging to an idea out of fear of nothingness. So that's why they're called realists. Because they believe in real, they have to cling to this notion of real because they're afraid of meaninglessness, nothingness, voidness. So it's their sense of realness. So actually, eternalism and nihilism go like two sides of a coin. Once something is, it can be isn't. So, you know, this is how it works with the philosophical views. And they can be very vulnerable. Thinking something is true when things are always moving and changing in a relationship leaves you quite vulnerable in a certain kind of way. So that's why the arhats had this heart attack. That's the story of the... And I think that Carl Brunholz wrote this book, The Heart Attack Sutra, after these two monks. It is a nice book. He's such a good scholar. So the question, you know, comes, you know, why do things actually have to be real to be experienced? You know, what does real mean to me? What are the implications of thinking about things as being real? Because things are in relationship, they are empty. Now here's the second part of that quote. Okay, so because things are in relationship, they are empty. Because they are empty, they can arise. Because if things were intrinsic, everything would be inert. If things existed from their own side, there'd be no relationship, there'd be no creativity, there'd be no movement. So now our mantra has changed. It's become longer. Because things are in relationship, they are empty. And because they are empty, they can arise. Gosh. Are you guys still, to be honest, Should I stop now? I was going to do another little logic here.
Go for it.
Go for it? Okay. Okay, let me go for it. This is really
good.
Say
that last, all of that yeah. together again, please.
Because things, okay, you know, because things are in relationship, they are empty. So now part two. Because they are empty, they can arise or appear, express themselves, whatever. Well, this part is fun anyway, so... I'm just going to introduce a little contemplation so you could also practice this at home. This is one of the easiest contemplations that there is. And it was taught by the 8th century scholar Shantarakshita in his text, the Umajan, which Sri Rinpoche actually has taught recently. I don't know if he taught it here, but in Crestone. And it looks at things in terms of whether they are general or specific, singular or many. So as we discussed above, we can't find anything that exists as a singular thing. As long as it has thingness, it's vulnerable. It can break apart. It's dependent. So even in science, you know, they find this. So there was this one linguist who was very interesting, and his name was Alfred Korzybski. That's it, Alfred Korzybski. And he lived in the early part of the 20th century, and he's famous for his quote, "The map is not the territory." In other words, what is being described is not the same as its description. Things are not what we label them to be, basically. The map is not the territory. So, for instance, I don't know, you might have a map of Portland. You go to that pretty place where there's that bay out there. I don't know. What is it? Casco Bay. And you have a map. The map is not the same as the bay itself. When you go to the bay, you see all kinds of things, boats and people and the waters moving around and cars and grass and trees and whatever have you. It's all there. So you might say, oh, well, this is the real thing. And Korzybski says that too. He just is very limited in how far he takes his theory for some reason. He'd say, well, you know, the physical, what did he say? He said the only link between the objective world and the linguistic world is found in structure and structure alone. So in other words, this bay, all these rocks and trees and physical things, he called structure, they're true. But the map wasn't true. But the Madhyamakan wouldn't say that. They'd say, look deeper. They would say, look at a boat, or look at a rock, or a tree. Look at a tree. What we label a tree is actually a map. It's like the map. It's an abstraction that we label on a series of parts. So if you look at the tree, you see a trunk. You see maybe pine needles. I don't know if you have pine trees here. Pine needles and pine cones and branches. So again, we have the same situation. The map is the tree is a label we impute upon. And then we can take a pine cone and we can look at the pine cone. We can say, oh, this is real. But in fact, the pine cone is made out of parts. It has all those petal-like things, and it has a core and fuzzy stuff. I don't know pine cones that well, but, you know, all different parts. And you can take each little piece of that until you get to the very last atom. You can say, well, this is real. The atom is real. But, of course, as we have discussed, the atom itself isn't real either. It's made of parts. It doesn't exist from its own side. Atom is a label we impute upon just this, it's just an idea. It's a concept. So this is a very interesting thing to do when we feel this kind of vivid sense of realness, in that we really think we know what something is. So this is, I wanted to, you know, I just want to introduce to you the kind of flavor of some of these inquiries, I guess. And so we can't, you know, things don't have those kind of boundaries. Boundaries are things we impute. It's that lumping that I talked about. Lump summing, you know, as my teacher says, lump summing of our experience that we're actually doing. So it's important to know that. In that way, the map is not the territory in anything. You know, not just the paper map, but the conceptual map. So everything is compounded and made of relationship. Where is the thingness? Where is this intrinsic real thing? We can't find one. We can't find one in many, and we can't find one in mass. And so yet we tend to hold on to that. So, you know, I think I'll conclude it by saying, you know, we have this sense of wanting to find, the main reason we study this is we want to find a sense of security. You know, we're always holding on to existence. This is what we do. But what we find is insecurity. Because how can you find security in a world that's changing all the time? This is a setup for, you know, disappointment, constant disappointment. And it's very interesting. We had this discussion this morning. My friend Rebecca here was talking to her daughter, who's a young woman, 21. Yeah. And, you know, the bombing happened yesterday, and I hope your family was okay, by the way. Is everything okay?
Yes, we are.
Okay, good. Yeah. We were all thinking about it last night. And, you know, these things scare young people because here they're moving into the world, you know. And it, like we were saying this morning, you can't go to a movie because there's been shootings. You know, you can't run a race because there's bombs. You know, there's problems in the violence in the schools, shootings in the schools, so you don't even feel safe sending your kids to school. And we're just talking about that sense of just not knowing what's going to happen. And I think that's pretty pervasive nowadays in certain ways. But I think it was always there because I was telling Gina and Rebecca, like, remembering being that age, or even younger maybe, and sitting on the porch of my front house and knowing that Russia had a missile pointed at the United States. That just really, really petrified me. Were you afraid of that too, Peter?
Yes.
What an image. Yeah, like why?
In the sky for H-bombs coming down.
Yeah, this is very scary, you know. And, you know, we're talking about being a mother and wanting to protect your children from this. And yet, in some way, you know, you can't really tell them everything's going to be okay. Like, I remember teaching this about faith, and I was in Amsterdam, and one mother told me her daughter, she was having a hard time. She said, everything's going to be okay. And the daughter said, but how can you actually say that everything's going to be okay? You know, that's kind of an interesting challenge, that statement. And in one way, you know, we can't say everything's going to be okay because it is in movement and it's rambunctious. But how do we also prevent ourselves from falling into nihilism and meaninglessness in the face of that? This is really the human predicament. What are we going to do about this? How are we going to live like this? And what are we going to tell our children? How are we going to learn this, you know? This is really the question. I think this is like the basic question for us as practitioners. These are the two extremes. You're either trying to make everything okay and maintain everything, or you're fall into nihilism, which is actually a depression, which is like a downer, you know. So, you know, in a way, this whole thing is really about finding a way to live in this basic human predicament. How do we rest there as a question? Because when we say human predicament, predicament doesn't mean negative. It just means complex. It means more than complex. It means it's full. Life is rich. That's what it means. So rich that it leaves us in a state of awe, you know? And we need to be big enough for it. And being big enough for our life means that we're not falling in those extremes. It's the most courageous that we can be. This is a bodhicitta aspect of this. We think bodhicitta might be just compassion, but bodhicitta is the fearlessness that comes from being big enough for the complexity and the fullness and this being able to live in the fact that we're in this predicament, you know? So I always think I told my friend Rebecca too, because having a son myself, there's something very good about what her daughter is going through, I feel, because she's emerging from a sleepy state. She's starting to see her predicament. Unless you see your predicament, you can't, this idea of moving toward courage and cultivating courage is not even a possibility. And we as adults need to move. And this is why on this path we contemplate so much impermanence, the suffering of samsara. It's not just to torture ourselves, it's to actually enliven us to where we are situated. and to move us, create a possibility to become courageous people. Because if we don't, we won't become courageous people. You know? So this is why we study Majjhimaka, really. Believe it or not, I've gone to the, you know, all these philosophies to this. But do you see the connection? Okay. Whew. That's good. Okay, I'll stop talking. But we can all talk together. Yeah, okay, now you can have your question.
Yes, I think this is where a question is, and it's building off of what you're talking about right here.
Yeah.
So as I was basically doing my homework, which my homework for me was kind of thinking about everything that you said yesterday and practicing today, sort of. So as the things are coming up and the mental weather's going through and I'm practicing sort of not, you know, seeing the non-existence or not connecting with that. But so that I was wondering if I would just like to ask you if there's very particular practical, because you have to kind of park the mind somewhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly I'm at that stage where the mind has to go somewhere. It's not going to follow that particular thought, you know, and I've had my various things that I do, like I'll feel my feet or I'll feel my heart or I'll do different types of things. But I would just love to hear a little bit of like what has maybe really worked for you or things that really work for you, because, you know, the mind wants to go there. Mm-hmm. And then I think sometimes part of the scariness can be, okay, if it doesn't go there, then what? Where does it go? Like, how can I have a nice place?
Yeah. Well, there's so many different resting places on the path.
Yeah. But let's say in a daily, like when you're working, or you know, you're not sitting, you're just going through your life.
Well, you know, they say in the military, when challenged, you default to the level of your training. So if you're training, you might default to that level of your training. Do you know what I mean? It's like you can't create a practice place of ease if you haven't prepared yourself for that. So that's why we practice, so that when we're not in a meditation, we can access our practice. So you start with calm abiding. Calm abiding practice. I was just telling Gina in the car, a very interesting story about a friend of mine who was in prison for 7 years, and she had just a horrible upbringing and ended up on the streets and gotten caught in violence and drugs and all kinds of things. So she ended up in prison, and in prison, the prison was really rough, and she said she used to melt down styrofoam cups to make knives to defend herself, and she got into a lot of trouble, and she was in solitary for 3 years. And then they let her out through an hour a day for exercise. And in that hour, somehow, she developed some kind of relationship with this cook. Just, you know, they talked. And the cook was an Indian man from India, Hindu. And he told her, if you don't discipline your mind, you know, you will go crazy in solitary. She said, I don't know how to discipline my mind. And he said, you know, she says, all I know how to do is count and pace. He said, count and pace. And she did count and pace for 3 years. She could walk 7 steps in each direction. And she said she had to wear paper shoes in solitary for some reason. They make you wear paper shoes. So every day she'd wear out her paper shoes and her feet were bleeding. She counted and paced so much. And she's really buff. She did a lot of sit-ups and push-ups and all that. And that's all she did. So she created a very strong container for her mind, like this strong sense of discipline. And she didn't go crazy. And actually, to be honest, she's pretty sane. She appreciates everything. I don't know. It takes some kind of strength, because her mind was really messed up when she went in. You know, I was talking to someone who works on a prison project in Rhode Island, this Fleet Mall, and they're friends of mine. And they're saying people in prison, their mind is just outrageous and traumatized, and you know, women are the worst too. They're the most traumatized because they've been raped, and you know, the whole thing. But she's good. Mm-hmm. She's really unspoiled and really strong. So it's like you have to train, and then after that you move. That's your resting place. It's like the calm abiding place, and then you train more, and you learn bodhicitta, and you train more, and you start to see that things are empty, so that you're not so naive and you're not so reactive. You know, somebody does something you like, you start to see more of them. You realize there's causes and conditions to this situation. You might even see that, oh, maybe it's a little subjective. my take on this situation. You don't you're not as reactive. So that's why we're doing all of this. So we can fall to the level of our training. You know, does that make sense? So, you know, just on the spot, just to expect to do something, it takes mental, like, it takes your, not just mental muscle, it takes the muscle of your entire being to do something that you're not habituated to doing. So we're trying to habituate ourselves to a different way of doing things. So it's like an unbrainwashing process. So you have to, you start on your cushion. Does that make sense? Okay. Yeah, in the back. Okay. I put my glasses.
Okay. you touched here briefly on the idea that you know, this, the Majarika, gives rise to bodhicitta. And can you talk just a little bit more on that?
Yeah. What's similar to, were you here last night?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. You know, what I was saying, when we look at someone as evil, and we start to look at the causes and conditions for what they did, mm-hmm. and we start to see them in relationships with other people, like their family or their mother, you know, we start to see how much they suffer. It's hard to be aggressive toward them, angry toward them. Like, I, in my book, I have this one example I think is a really helpful example for myself about aggression. You know, in the, when people send the soldiers to war, they're trained to objectify the enemy, mm-hmm. to see them in a very one-dimensional way. Because if you start to look at the enemy as like someone's son or someone's, I don't know, brother, it's hard to kill them. Mm-hmm. So it's like the minute we start seeing people in a more open-dimensional way, compassion happens naturally. The more you step into emptiness, the more compassionate you come. That's why when we talk about bodhicitta, we say it has two aspects. It has compassion, love, you know, these unbiased care, equality, you know, and we rejoice in their happiness. This, together with emptiness, it's not, bodhicitta is not just compassion. A lot of people think it is. Bodhicitta is emptiness and compassion together. So the more we cultivate compassion rather than shutting down around our habits, the more we see emptiness, right? The more we see emptiness, the more our actions also become compassionate. The two can't be separated. Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
And yeah.
Associated with this is equanimity, I imagine.
Yes. Yes, of course. Yeah, and that's why we use the four immeasurables to cultivate equanimity and compassion and love and so forth. And we practice the paramitas. You know, we practice exchanging self and other. But they're mixed. You can't separate. So the minute we step out of our own small self, you know, to serve others, we're already stepping into emptiness in some way. So, yeah, Bill.
Elizabeth, could you, in the beginning, you were talking about, and you know, and it's often described in the scriptures, of to use the analytical meditations and that they will bring us to insight. And I guess I'm sort of asking, could you talk a little bit, love this material and fruitionally, but in how it shifts from one to the other, because one is conceptual and, you know, we're working the mind.
Yeah.
And, you know, like many times, like Fungal, you know, people will say, you know, in the context of now Mahamudra, right, they'll be saying, yes, but the intellectual, you know, just sort of thinking about this intellectually, thinking about the right view intellectually would not bring us to insight.
Mm-hmm.
They're different. And then in the very next breath, he'll say how important it is to get the critical mind. So could you talk about that shift? And sometimes they talk about, you know, getting conviction. So getting a really good, solid, you kind of know it's there, you know it's accurate, valid, inferential, but still no guarantees. they trunk room to say, could you talk about how sort of how they do, one does kind of move to the other?
Yeah. I'm glad you're really asking this, and I forgot to say a little piece too, and so it just reminded me of that. You know, you do the analysis, and you look, and you look, and you look for an intrinsic thing, and you break things apart, and at some point you don't find, then they always say rest in not finding. Mm. Rest in not finding. This is very profound. And this actually is like this idea of open question. You're not disengaged. You're completely engaged, and yet there's no conclusion. It's like, can we bear it? Can we bear not knowing in the habitual way? It's like another kind of knowing. There's compassion and clarity and intelligence in it, but it's not shutting down around these conceptual conclusions. And there's a word for this, and this is what I meant to say. Tutral means free of elaborations. It's the knowing that is not, doesn't have all this extra stuff. It's knowing without beliefs. This is what I was supposed to conclude on, because I told you I was going to get there and I forgot. I got distracted. Other ideas. So that's why I was saying in the beginning, it's a viewless view. If you could cling to emptiness as a view as well, then it's just another belief. Then it's just another obstruction. So really what we want to do is get to the point where then we let go and rest in not finding. And that is very profound. Very profound. And that kind of leads us to the Dharmakaya or what have you. And sometimes we don't, you know, it takes a pointing out instruction to do that from the teacher, because the teacher points us directly to the mind. We're not analyzing in the same way, and there's a sense of transmission. I feel for me, there's something about the process of analyzing, and it was, believe me, it's not easy. It wasn't easy for me. I really had to think through, what does this really mean? But I feel that it shifted the whole way I see things, such a profound way. And then when I went into retreat, because I studied a lot before I went into retreat, something all fell into place with it, because I was able to sit and practice. So we should continue to practice while we do it, and we should look for the middle way in our practice, which really means a moment of insight or a moment free of grasping and rejection, eternalism and nihilism, you know, meaning and meaninglessness, ground and no ground. This is also, this is an experience too, is what I'm trying to say. So, you know, all this together, we have to do everything we can, because we have to unbrainwash and reverse our habits. Our mind is not habituated to emptiness or tritral. The mind is habituated to grasping onto beliefs and views. Therefore, we need, that.
Thank you.
Of course. Yeah.
So to follow up on Bill's question, as a practice there, would you sort of analyze and rest?
As a practice, yeah, you analyze and rest.
Sort of alternating that.
Yeah, that would be fantastic if you could do that. And there are practices where you do that. You analyze. Mm-hmm. Even in the Dzogchen teachings, there's a kind of a teachings where you actually look and you look and you look and you look and then you rest for a while. Then you look and you look and you look. Yeah. It's very profound. And you can use the logic to do it. You could take it, just that little one that I talked about today, where the map is not the territory, and do it. You know, or there's other ones, but it's great to learn them and then just use them. And then the next time you get angry, maybe remember them a little bit. Yeah. Well, great.
He's clapping for everything.
Oh!
so many questions, but it's just so inspiring.
Oh, I'm so happy. Mm-hmm. It's really risky. I feel like I feel this is risky to teach. You don't know how well this is going to go over. Mm-hmm. But why I decided to teach it here is because it's a Trungrum Chase Center, and I felt maybe something that it would hold. And it seems, I hope people aren't confused. You don't look confused. Yeah. Well, I'm a little confused too. We're all a little confused. but yeah, not to the point of like, wow, you know, overwhelm. It just, people don't look overwhelmed, so I'm hoping that's how it is. Thank you for saying that because it makes me feel happy. Tomorrow we have a doozy again. Yeah, tomorrow is a really interesting one. So, well, thank you so much for helping me and being here. Surrounded by snow mountains, source of complete happiness and benefit. Avalokiteshvara, Tenzin Jamso, may you stand firm until the end of existence. Unborn, eternal, self-arising Dharmakaya arises as a miraculous kaya of form. May the three secrets of the Karmapa be stable in the Vajra nature. And may his limitless Buddha activity spontaneously blaze. Splendor of the teaching, Karma Lodro, may you remain steadfast. Your qualities of the glorious and excellent Dharma increase to fill space. May your lotus feet always be stable. And may your Buddha activity of teaching and practice blaze victoriously in all directions. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be freed.